We're talking with the Wisconsin State Soil Scientist here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Jennifer Smith, on the job since March, will develop, manage, and direct a technical soil services program for our state. With 17 years under her belt as a soil scientist in the Midwest in both the public and private sector, what do you want to know about our soil health? Are you curious about our official state soil? 800-642-1234. The state soil scientist is housed within the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS. Jennifer also serves as state liaison to the National Cooperative Soil Survey Cooperators. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, give us a thumbnail sketch, if you would, of what a soil scientist is.
Oh, boy. We have all day. Basically, a soil scientist goes out and looks at the soil properties, both physical, chemical, and the biological factors. Back in the day, we used to only really look at those physical properties and how I can grow a crop in it. But now it's so much more, and we're really looking into soil health to make sure that we have a sustainable ecosystem and we can continue to grow our crops. Very important, very important. It's difficult to say what a life in a soil scientist is on a typical day, because we're doing all sorts of things. We're in the field, we're in the office, we're talking to producers, we're talking to kids. Let me tell you, it's the best job on earth.
Well, notable, I might add, you are our state's first female soil scientist. Anything you'd like to say there?
Yeah, I just recently found out about that, and I am truly honored, and I'm not going to lie, I'm a little bit, feel the pressure, but I'm excited to be in Wisconsin, and I can't wait. I'm still new in the job, mm-hmm. But I can't wait to get going and meet landowners in Wisconsin and continue to spread the word of soil. I love soil, and I love talking about soil, so I can't wait.
We can hear that in your voice. We often hear about healthy soil, but it's so fuzzy in my head. What makes a soil healthy?
Right? Yeah. So it's not really a new concept, but it's one of our buzzwords. And we really do want to make sure that we have healthy soils, because if we don't, so soil, why should we care, right? Who mm-hmm. cares? It's just dirt. But soil is vital to life. We can't live without it, and it's not a renewable resource. So we really need to make sure that we do take care of our soil. So what is a healthy soil? A healthy soil is something that can continue growing our crops. And it can, Mother Nature made it to act like a sponge. It can also hold water. So in those times where, I'm currently not in Wisconsin, but has Wisconsin been under a drought? So those years mm-hmm. when there's a drought, when we have some moisture in the soil, if the soil is healthy, it can hold on to that moisture. And in times in the summer when we're going through those dry periods, that water's still available to our plants. A healthy soil has great soil structure, has great organic matter, and it's really important to make sure that we keep our soils healthy. So with NRCS, we have four principles. So we want to minimize the soil disturbance. So less passes, less tillage. We want to maximize the diversity. So that could be crop rotation. Instead of just doing a monoculture of just corn, maybe we put corn, beans, and a small grain in there. Hey, if we can incorporate cover crops and a multi-species cover crop, that's great. We're maximizing the diversity. Microbes are kind of like us, mm-hmm. and we want a diverse diet, right? We don't want to just eat bread and water.
That would not be good. No, bad.
and not healthy, right? What happens if you just have bread and water? You're going to go to the doctor. You're going to need vitamins. Well, same for our soil microbes. They want that diversity. So if we can add some more plants in there and they offer different sugars, the microbes will come and they'll be healthier. We also want to keep the soil covered. So that could be with residue, if we leave our corn residue out there, or if we have a cover crop, we're keeping it covered. And we want to maximize the living roots. Mother Nature, we had tall grass prairie, and the soil was covered and it was protected, had a diverse variety of plants, and it was covered all year round. So if in our agronomic systems, if we could kind of mimic Mother Nature, mm-hmm. then we can build healthier soils.
Well, let me reintroduce you. We're with Jennifer Smith. She is Wisconsin State Soil Scientist with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. And your soil health questions front and center, 800-642-1234. Jennifer, I understand one of the favorite parts of your job is really getting out there into schools, talking about soil to different age groups. What do you hope this does to educate future generations?
Yeah, I love going out. Man, let me tell you, these kids, they are smart. come up with excellent questions. I just hope to, who knew that you could study soil, right? Who knew? It's just, again, it's just dirt. It's something we build on. It's something we put some plants in, but who cares? It's just dirt. But that's really not the case. And I hope to open their eyes and realize it. It's so much more, and it's so important. So whether they want to continue and be farmers, just realize how important that soil is. Whether they want to go on and continue and be a soil scientist, hey, that's great. Unfortunately, we're losing a lot of interest in the soils programs due to budgetary constraints. Some schools, colleges need to cut their programs. So hey, let's get an interest in soil going. Or, you know, shoot, I heard one of the PhDs, a microbiologist, say that they don't even know 95% of the different kinds of microbes that are in the soil.
Wow.
Oh, man, you young kids or anyone who wants to go back to school, please study that because we need that information. Even though we can't see those microbes, they're so important to our soil health.
So on that note, in terms of research and understanding Wisconsin soil, what are some of your top priorities and goals as you work with Wisconsin and its soil?
Good question. So first, I want to clarify, NRCS is not a research agency, but we do special studies, and any landowner who's interested in what their soils look like, please contact your local field office or Google up a soil scientist or myself, and we can come out and we can do some field assessments. We can see, is your soil healthy? Can we improve it? Can we improve the organic matter? Do you have soil erosion, wind, water concerns? We can go out there and we can do certain assessments and see where your soil's at, and then make recommendations how to improve.
Let's take a call now. Marcus is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What is on your mind with soil?
So I was just wondering how your guest feels about what Native Americans used to call the Three Sisters. They'd take a fish, and in the mouth of the fish, they'd put a squash seed, a corn seed, and a bean seed. And so that way the corn would grow up and provide a trellis for the beans. The squash would provide ground cover, and it was perfectly balanced for nitrogen as well as the other stuff. And basically it was a way to do it without pesticides or fertilizers.
Marcus, thank you. Jennifer.
Wow, Marcus. I'll be honest, I've never heard that, but that's very interesting. And the Native Americans, very, very smart people, very resourceful. I think that we need to get back to, again, and mimic Mother Nature. And if we can limit our tillage, and if we can incorporate these soil health practices, maybe baby steps, then I think we're going to have a healthier ecosystem. And the microbes will do their job, the soil will do their job, and then hopefully we won't need to use those pesticides and herbicides and things like that.
We're talking with Wisconsin's new state soil scientist, Jennifer Smith. She also serves as the state liaison with the National Cooperative Soil Survey. What questions do you have about soil mapping and soil health? Have you tried to improve the soil on your land? How do you do that? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jennifer Smith on the Ideas Network. We're appreciating our soil resources on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. I came across a quote on the USDA's Wisconsin State Soil Information page. It's by the late UW-Madison soil science professor Francis D. Hole, who lobbied hard to get an official state soil, and the legislature made it a reality in 1983. So Hole said, soil is the hidden secret friend, which is the root domain of lively darkness and silence. What does soil mean to you? 800-642-1234. State soil scientist Jennifer Smith is with us for 10 more minutes. Jennifer, Antigo silt loam, our official state soil. Can you give us a little more of that history lesson on how that came to be?
Good question. So just like states have state birds, flowers, and I apologize, I don't know the certain year when Antigo was named as the state soil, but same thing. It was lobbied, and it was a big production for many states, and usually it was a common soil in that state. So that's the brief history that I have on that. I still have not seen Antigo, and I'm excited to meet it.
I love that. Why is this soil so important in our state?
Well, we're a huge farming community. We feed the world, so we need to take care of our soils. I saw this quote that a fellow former graduate student and current soil scientist had on her email. There is no life without soil and no soil without life. Mm. Again, it's not a renewable resource. We really need to take care of it. If we don't have soil, we don't have life. We're in big trouble. So in Wisconsin and it's in the Midwest, farming communities, we really want to take care of our soil. Once that top, that fertile soil on the topsoil, that black, beautiful soil, once it's gone, it's gone. We can't get it back. So we need to figure out how to keep it healthy, how to keep it on our land and not blowing or washing off to our neighbor's land. We really need to take care of our soil so we can not just keep things going, but have a regenerative situation system. So really looking at our soils and taking care of them and having our soils work for us is really important.
Let's bring in John now in Eau Claire. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. My question is my wife and I have changed our whole backyard and stuff and front yard into a pollinator garden with different types of plants and stuff. And we use cocoa bean mulch on top of that. But my question is, really, what can I do to improve the soil that's underneath by putting on a topical or something on the top of it?
I don't think you need to. Are you having any issues growing those native pollinators?
No, other than the rabbits.
Well, they're just doing their job, too. I don't think you, I think continue doing what you're doing, and you're mimicking Mother Nature in our tall grass prairies. And when those plants die off, that organic matter is going to be added to the soil. So I think, thank you for doing that. And you're also increasing the population of our pollinators, and that's extremely important as well.
John, may I ask how long you've been growing your pollinator gardens? How has it been growing up? How long have you been doing it?
Well, actually, I'm the weeder, and my wife is the designer and stuff. And I got to think about this at least 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That we've been doing it. And we actually tried to do some stuff with for monarchs.
Uh-huh.
And we get some monarchs and stuff, and we get some other, you know, different types of butterflies, one that I've never seen before the other day on top of some things that I put in.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's great. So, can I ask a question?
Sure.
What made you decide to do this?
Other than my wife told me.
Okay, what made your wife decide?
Oh, dear. We just lost him, actually. Sorry about that. Somehow we just lost that connection. Let's go to Gene now in Knapp. Gene, hi.
Hi, yes. I was wondering, does the NRCS have, on their website, have citations for the looking at the soil loss for all the different various agricultural practices? And the greenhouse gas release per unit production for the various agricultural practices. It's my understanding that the only agricultural practices that practice that results in enhancement of the soil is a rotational grazing, and it also captures greenhouse gases.
So to answer your first question, I don't believe so. I could be wrong, but I don't believe so. And yes, a rotational grazing, I mean, anytime we can leave anything more in its natural state will be more beneficial and not release greenhouse gases. That is also going to be a big focus within our agency, how to sequester carbon and how to keep it in the soil.
But
my understanding is any row crop results in the release of greenhouse gas.
Anytime you disturb the soil, we're releasing some carbon into the atmosphere.
That was my question. Thank you.
Yeah, Gene, thank you. And along those lines of carbon sequestration, Mike in Black River Falls. Mike, go ahead.
Hi. I recently watched an interesting documentary. Woody Harrelson was involved in it. And basically, you mentioned about the carbon. And anyway, he showed that through farming practices, which are probably kind of differ from the way mass farming is done, you can actually remove carbon from the atmosphere, or at least as I recall, I'm not a soil scientist, whereas a lot of the mass farming, which as you pointed out, there's a lot of disturbance of the soil, a lot of pesticides, et cetera, that actually introduces carbon into the atmosphere. It almost sounds like by changing farming, it could be a major contributor towards the elimination of carbon in the atmosphere and help, significantly with the reduction of, climate change
that
we're seeing. Yeah.
Let's get Jennifer's take there.
So I think you're referring to maybe Kiss the Ground. I also watched that. I think we need to be a little bit careful here because farmers are doing their best, and they're not the only contributors to the greenhouse gases. We contribute every day we turn our vehicle on. So any small steps that any of us can take to reduce those greenhouse gases, we should try and do our best.
We're talking with Jennifer Smith, who is the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service State Soil Scientist. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jennifer, I do want to ask you about data mapping, digital data mapping, and what that means for soil, how it's done, and what you can do with that information.
Sure. So first off, I want to say that all of our official data is on online called Web Soil Survey. You can just Google Web Soil Survey. It's available to the public. You can print all sorts of reports and maps, and that's always readily available. You can search that by your address, your county, or if you know your township range and section. There's various ways to be able to search the data. If you have any issues, just give us a call, and anybody with the field office or area office can help you out. There's two different branches of soil scientists in our agency. One is with the state, which is where I lie, and I'm usually the state soil scientist, an assistant soil scientist, a soil health specialist, and then we also have resource soil scientists. Then on the other side, we have more of the soil survey or major land resource area soil scientists. And these are the soil scientists who are still, if an area hasn't been mapped yet, which is very few and far between, they go out and do the mapping projects. And back in the day, it was you had a clipboard, you had some maps, you had your pencil, and you went out and you did your mapping. And you had certain acre goals you needed to complete. And back in the day, they had stereoscopes. Now we have computers. We have all these different layers of data. It's available at our fingertips. We can use LIDAR. I will tell you that this digital soil mapping is amazing. I don't understand it all because it's GIS modeling, so ArcGIS. Mm-hmm. But they go out and they land truth it as well. And it's amazing, and it's supposed to give us more accurate spatial and tabular data. So what's accurately out in the land, out on the landscape.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. This was great. We had some great questions. And again, anytime I can talk about soil is a great day.
I love it. Jennifer Smith is the Wisconsin State Soil Scientist in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the role of guidance documents issued by federal agencies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, issued a guidance document in late May titled Emergency Use Authorization for Vaccines to Prevent COVID-19. Clearly, very important guidance. One of the first sentences on the 25-page guidance to industry: the FDA is committed to providing timely guidance to support response efforts to this pandemic. Do you adhere to guidance documents in your industry? Were you ever confused by guidance issued by the CDC or other agencies? Do you know where to find these documents? Have you provided public comment? 800-642-1234. Susan Webb-Yockey is director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison and a professor of public affairs and political science. Her new report is called Guidance on Regulatory Guidance, What the Government Needs to Know and Do to Engage the Public. Susan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. I'm so delighted to be here.
Well, give us a working definition of guidance documents. How do you describe them?
Yeah, so guidance documents are policy tools that are used by federal agencies as well as state agencies, and they're really used to make policy statements on behalf of those government entities. They, in particular, are used to clarify the meaning of existing statutes or existing regulations, but really they provide the state-of-the-art thinking of that agency's on any particular policy topic.
Yeah, I mean, in your report, you call these documents forward-looking policy instruments. Can you kind of explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so if you think about a congressionally passed statute or a government rule and regulation that passed through the notice and comment process, which is a very kind of technical and legalistic process to make legally binding rules, those statutes and those rules are instruments. They're ways in which governments make policy decisions. And agency guidance documents are policy instruments too. They're just a different means of making those decisions. And one of the reasons they're so attractive to government agencies is that they can be issued, at least at present, really quickly. And they create a great level of responsiveness of those government agencies to changing circumstances. They also have some negative and downsides as well, but the real positives are that they're timely and flexible tools.
Yeah, because certainly the policymaking process itself can sometimes be long and arduous, so these, you see them more as sometimes quick fixes, Band-Aids.
Well, that's one way to think about it. I mean, we need to have a plethora of tools in our toolkit for government actors. And certainly guidance documents are one tool that are quicker and more flexible. Think of presidential executive orders as another tool that's pretty quick and can be issued with really no process or no deliberation and compromise. Guidance documents are similar to that.
Well, speaking of executive orders, President Biden's time in office, right away he acted in January with this executive order. What is the president trying to do about guidance documents?
Yeah, so presidents from both sides of the political aisle, as well as members of Congress from both sides of the political aisle, have long seen some problems related to the guidance document process. Let me just list a couple of those problems. So I already mentioned some of the positives. They're They're flexible, they're timely responses that the government agencies can issue to try to clarify statutes and regulations for businesses or the public. But there's some downsides too. For instance, agencies define guidance document really differently. And so that makes it hard to understand what they are across different agencies. Mm-hmm. Another problem is there's no place that collects all guidance documents together and kind of brings them together in a uniform spot for citizens and businesses to understand kind of what the current thinking is on agencies. And a couple others is that there's no way for the public to uniformly comment on really important guidance documents. And so when President Biden got into office, he was looking back at some of the efforts of President Trump and kind of deciding where he wants to make his mark, like every president does. And one of the first things he did was rescind, revoke or take back, an executive order that President Trump issued on guidance documents. And that executive order that President Trump issued was really trying to raise the transparency and the level of public engagement and guidance. Now, I expect President Biden will very likely issue his own executive order or do something in the policy space on the guidance document process. It might be a little different than what President Trump did, but again, presidents of both parties recognize that there's a need to make this process more transparent and easier for the public to understand.
So if guidance is not meant to be binding, how are agencies able to enforce their guidance documents?
Yeah, that's a great question. You really hit the nail on the head. Guidance is guidance, right? It's supposed to guide public behavior. But the trick is that, and many commenters have suggested this across time, is that businesses and citizens often treat guidance as binding, right? Some scholars say it, quote, coerces compliance, end of quote, right? And the reason it does that is that, again, these guidance documents are the agency's current thinking, their best thinking on their kind of policymaking decisions. And agencies make a lot of important policy decisions for businesses and citizens. So they make enforcement decisions where they might assign penalties to businesses for not complying. So we see that in, for instance, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA space, where they might fine a company for pollutants, for instance. Or you see that in the permitting space, where before you can go forward with your construction project, you need to have the right permitting. Right. Mm-hmm. So agencies use these guidance documents to help make those decisions. Right. So if you are not in compliance with the guidance document, you might have an enforcement action against you, or you might not get that permit. So it really, they do really have teeth, even if they are only guidance.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Susan Webb-Yockey, who's director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, and she's a professor of public affairs, wrote a recent report on how to improve guidance documents. You can join in. Have you ever been confused by guidance issued recently in the CDC, in the pandemic, or other agencies? Have you had issues understanding federal or state guidance? Join in, 800-642-1234. Susan, I was reading a report just came out in Pharma Intelligence that said the FDA is struggling to regulate the supplements industry, in part because draft guidance on compliance with all these new dietary ingredients, the guidance, it's not coming out fast enough, and that the oversight lags behind the explosive growth of the supplement market. Of course, we don't have all the facts here, but how would guidance documents be failing in a situation where an industry is changing really, really quickly?
So all policy documents are, and all kind of policy vehicles are going to be challenged in any industry that changes really quickly. So you just mentioned one, Kate, but all of us have experienced the COVID-19 crisis and the change across time in what we've learned about the science behind that virus. And that's why you're seeing, you know, the kind of fits and starts of guidance documents being issued by places like the FDA or the CDC, you know, coming out and sort of backtracking and coming out with a new guidance document. They're trying to catch up with the latest state of the science. And we need all of our government policy agencies to be making their decisions based on the state of the art science. When it's changing, you can expect that guidance documents are going to have to change alongside them.
Well, certainly many Americans who have never paid attention to guidance documents paid close attention to what the CDC was coming out with on their guidance in COVID. Do you think this marks a new beginning on guidance documents and how we pay attention to them?
Well, they've certainly never been in the news more than right now. All right, so if you think back to February and the CDC's announcement of K through 12 school reopenings, they had a guidance document about kind of what was the state of the art thinking on how schools would reopen. It was enormously controversial. And obviously, you know, to every parent out there, including myself, enormously impactful as well. Again, it was guidance, but we were hearing from, you know, state and local officials, teachers, principals, union members, parents, that their schools were taking that guidance documents as the implementable policy changes. They had felt like they had to meet those guidance in many cases, even though they were just guidance. So that's a great example of, you know, some of the impact the guidance has. I'll give you one more example that's really controversial. The Biden administration issued a new guidance document on Title IX protections for transgender students through the Department of Education. And that new guidance document is extending kind of greater privileges and protections to transgender students. And that comes at a time when we have at least 31 state legislatures across the United States issuing their own laws or going through the political process, at least, to potentially issue laws around similar issues, especially gender identity and sports, female sports in particular. So it's a great example of the Department of Education weighing in with a guidance document at the federal level on a terrifically contentious political issue.
And didn't the Obama administration do that as well with bathrooms for transgender students? I think it was in 2016, maybe.
Absolutely. It's actually, this is a kind of there's a through line between President Obama's guidance document on transgender students, which, you know, many of us heard a lot about. It had, you know, it had implications for bathroom use in schools. President Trump rescinded that guidance document through his administrative decision making. And now we see Biden back with a new guidance document. And, you know, that kind of progression of, you know, different political parties or kind of political approaches to different policy issues going back and forth through the guidance document process is an example of where this policy tool falls down a little bit. Because it's so easy, so flexible, there's no process attached to issuing guidance documents, they can be easily initiated and easily revoked by a new administration as well. And that leads to a lot of confusion amongst the public as well as businesses. I should mention, there are some really contentious issues like the masking mandate issued through guidance. But for the most part, it's businesses that are affected by guidance in the United States.
Well, we're going to look at solutions here in a moment with Susan Webb-Yaki, who leads the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, as she explains the challenges and constraints of guidance documents. Do you write these guidance documents, or is your industry dependent on clear guidance from the government and regulating something? Do you think more guidance would help with government transparency? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Susan Webb-Yaki on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the role and the reach of federal guidance documents and how to improve the system of describing an agency's interpretation of a policy. President Biden signed an executive order in January directing federal agencies to look inward at their policies, at their regulations, their guidance documents to see who's being left out and how they could better advance equity in agency policies and programs. What puzzles you about guidance documents? Do you follow them closely in your line of work? 800-642-1234 to join in. Susan Webb-Yaki directs the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs, and she stays with us. Susan, let's look at some of the solutions that you have come up with. And one recommendation you make is a government-wide repository to keep track of guidance documents. How would this work?
Yeah, so this is, I think, the most kind of common sense solution that I can put forward on the guidance process. And that's that we ought to be able to have a spot where all citizens and all businesses can look to find out what is what are the agency guidance documents from the different federal agencies? What are the ones that are current and being currently used by agencies? And what are some of the ones from the past so we can kind of track that past behavior too? Believe it or not, there's nothing like that. Right now, agency guidances are announced in kind of a haphazard way, sometimes in press releases, sometimes in letters to businesses and constituencies, sometimes in kind of more official policy pronouncements, but really hard to discern what is that, what are these agency guidance documents, especially if you're a regular citizen. You know, so a lot of businesses have full-time staffs, you know, lawyers and others that are tracking really carefully these guidance documents. You or I don't have that.
Yeah, guidance documents aren't like making headlines out there.
Not typically, right? And so what I'm proposing in these new set of reforms is something like a website repository that has some simple information on the government agencies themselves, as well as what are the guidance that they're currently using in making their decision making. Something that's searchable, something that we can turn to understand the agency's current thinking.
Something I'm curious about, I noticed in the FDA guidance documents, they say at the top of the page, guidance for industry. And I'm just wondering, is that pretty uniform among the federal agencies that they define their audience up top?
It's not. So again, because guidance documents are issued in such different formats,
yeah.
Right? So again, some are press releases, some are, you know, more kind of directed to industry. There is no kind of common way that's done.
They don't have like a template out there that they're just kind of filling in the information into these holes.
There's no template. And actually, Kate, that's a great point, because when we have templates for decision-making, it actually helps the audience understand the different components of a policy. We can read them much more quickly because we sort of understand where the agency is putting what information. And so that is part of this repository, the idea that there would be some kind of standardization of how the policy documents, these guidance documents, look. That again is going to help the reader more quickly discern what the key points are.
I'm still kind of hung up on how to reach the most people and how to do that effectively, especially when it's guidance that might not only impact your job, but maybe your life. And certainly we have seen that over mask wearing the pandemic. But how would like a guidance notification system work?
Yeah, so that's another reform that's suggested. So not only should we have this kind of one spot where it's a repository, kind of like a dumping ground for all current guidance, which is absolutely necessary, but we also need to have a way to signal new guidance, or let's also say rescinded guidance. So when an agency is going to take back their current thinking and are planning to modify it, we need to know that too, right? So we need to not be out there, you know, acting on good faith on what we think is an agency's current thinking when they have in fact rescinded it, or if they brought it back, maybe because science has changed, or maybe because there's some other issue that we're not aware of. And so in the report, I suggest let's take use of some new technologies to try to get, you know, guidance information out there to folks. You know, let's use Twitter, let's use Facebook, some of the other means by which we can broadcast to large groups of people at the same time, either new policy decisions or rescinded policy decisions. Here's where we can take advantage of the fact where we can kind of sign up on places like Twitter for different lists or different types of policy areas that we might be concerned of, where we can get information from government in a timely way.
We're talking with Susan Webb Yaki, who directs the La Follette School of Public Affairs, and she's a professor of public affairs and political science. She wrote a report recently on guidance for guidance documents. You can call in with your questions on guidance documents, 800-642-1234. Susan, let's look at the public engagement in guidance making. What role do public comments have? When do they come?
For most agencies, public comments don't play a role in the guidance process. There is an exception. So the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is the main exception. In the late 1990s, Congress was looking at how the FDA was making decisions, and they were realizing really quickly that major policy changes were going through the guidance process and not through the more traditional way in which agencies make regulatory decisions, and that's through the notice and comment rulemaking process. And I'll note that that notice and comment process has a public commenting piece to it, right? And so Congress was really concerned about that. And they were wanting to make sure that industries, regulated entities, citizens, they had a chance to participate in the FDA's policy decision-making. And so think about the FDA. It regulates cosmetics, animal food, your food, medical devices. It regulates drugs, pharmaceuticals, over-the-counter prescription drugs. I mean, a huge swath of things that you and I care about.
Lots and lots of tentacles, yes.
Yep. So Congress was wanting to make sure that there was a public process for commenting during guidance development, and it required it in this 1997 legislation. But for the rest of the federal agencies, there's no such requirement. And so my report suggests that there ought to be, at least for the most important guidance, some means for the public to participate and provide their input on guidance documents.
Are you optimistic that change could happen? Are you seeing any signs out there that there could be change?
I am optimistic. You know, I'm optimistic by the fact that, you know, during the Trump administration, this was an issue that was really forwarded as important. I'm optimistic by looking at the new executive order issued by the Biden administration, which calls out the need to look hard at the guidance document process. I'm also optimistic by the fact that, I mean, this is in the news right now. We recognize maybe not the vehicle, which is guidance documents, but we recognize the importance and the policy topics that guidance is touching. So I am optimistic that there could be some common sense bipartisan reforms in this area.
Susan, thank you for joining us.
I was so thrilled to be here. Thank you very much.
Susan Webb Yaki is director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, professor of public affairs and political science. We have a link, by the way, to her report. It's called Guidance on Regulatory Guidance. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, an author discusses their new book exploring the language of cults, and not only religious cults. We're talking about brands, corporate culture that use similar strategies to gain cult-like following. Stay with us. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.